Today, the recovery hits stall speed. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to the latest post covering finance and problem news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today, I'm joined again by journalist Tarek Brooker. Hi, Tarek.
G'day, Martin. How are you?
Yeah, pretty good. So we had a whole load of data that came out, and it's looking pretty wobbly, isn't it?
Yeah, to say the least, unfortunately. You know, we're seeing the GDP numbers came in, worse than expected. And more than that, you look around the world at all these various PMIs, services indexes, high frequency data indicators, and it's just showing the beginning of the 80 to 90% economy. Just everything's stalling, and we're not really seeing much further growth in a lot of countries.
Mm. And the point I think we need to underscore is that if you look at the last time things were pretty bad, the global financial crisis, right? The financial crisis hit, but the ramifications rumbled on for a number of years. Home prices fell for the subsequent 5 years. Business confidence decayed. More businesses went out of existence in years two and year three than in year one, right? And so that was a small crisis relative to what we're dealing with now, right? And therefore, we should assume that we are just in the foothills of what's going to happen. And yet, of course, our government is actually withdrawing stimulus. You know, it was 25% of GDP last quarter, 7.5% of GDP this quarter, and below 2% next quarter. Something doesn't add up.
Well, in a way, I sort of have to give them credit for not doing the whole extend and pretend with the entirety of stimulus. But by the same token, they need to be able to replace it with something that's going to drive a recovery. Now, I understand that, JobKeeper and all that sort of stuff isn't really all that effective. I mean, we saw that in the national accounts. We saw corporate profits get boosted by 15% to their highest level on record. You know, we saw record dividends and record profits from quite a few companies. So it's clear that JobKeeper is really doesn't work for its intended purpose.
The point is, it's actually company keeper, not job keeper.
Well, exactly. I mean, Labor MP Andrew Leigh said the other day in Parliament, he called it dividend keeper. And you're right. I mean, it's like we discussed, I think it was back in April when they first announced this policy. You know, we talked about something targeted at workers who are actually definitively being affected by the pandemic through this a UBI sort of thing, like what we've seen, similar to what we've seen in the UK, the way that they only pay the money to people who've been definitively furloughed or affected, rather than JobKeeper, which uses this sort of, what would you call it, the turnover-based system of, your turnover was down X, 30, 50% for a short period, we'll give you all this money. But, that's obviously just turned out to be, as you say, just company keeper.
Yeah, and look, you can be very creative with accounting, right? So you can report your turnover lower just to make sure that you actually can get all of that money, right? And I don't know that there's any dotted line that's clear between money coming into a company in JobKeeper and it flowing through to employees.
No. Well, I mean, it's just sort of like painfully simple maths, isn't it? You give a company that doesn't actually have reduced turnover for the vast majority of a period $1,500 to pay a worker, that's $1,500 that doesn't have to come out of the company's pocket. Yep. Now, however you want to sort of do that in terms of the actual accounting, it's $1,500 more than what they had before. So it just doesn't really make any sense to me that there was no provisions put in place to prevent, things like record dividend payouts or enormous executive bonuses and all those things to at least prevent that, or, not make a crap policy in the first place.
Yeah. So let's be clear then. The top end of town benefits from this way more than small businesses. Many small businesses I surveyed said they couldn't actually engage with JobKeeper. It was too complicated and it wouldn't have actually helped them anyway. They didn't have the funds available to be able to pay money out before the money came in, all of those things. So there were a lot of small businesses who really got no benefit from it at all. And as a result of that, you've got to say that you know, out of 10, you'd give JobKeeper, I think, about a 4 or a 5, no more than that. I think we should also talk about BankKeeper. That's not what it's officially called, but that's actually what the Reserve Bank has been doing, right? So basically, on Tuesday, Philip Lowe announced that they were going to provide even more funding to the banks over a longer term on the principle that the banks will lend more to the business sector. But it's really interesting to understand how little of that initial funding was actually lent out to businesses. So you sort of scratch your head thinking, well, hang on a moment. So the banks are getting more cheap funds, but are they going to actually lend it?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I read an article in The Spectator about this yesterday. The AFR was saying that $180 billion has been lent to businesses since February, but only $1.9 billion of that has been lent to small businesses through the government's, you know, the government-backed loan scheme through the banks.
Yep.
So what we're seeing is all of these bigger medium and large-sized businesses who have access to credit, who have access to, you know, sort of perhaps more collateral or more or something that makes them a more attractive prospect for the banks, they can draw down these lines of credit to the tune of well over $100 billion. When it comes to the smaller guys, when it comes to people who are on the bubble, who are in these marginal businesses who are really struggling, the support just isn't there. And I think that we're really going to start to see that flow through in the coming months. And I think that's probably part of the reason why at the moment we're seeing this big push from some quarters to extend the insolvency moratorium.
Yes, that's right. Well, of course, that's due to end quite soon, isn't it now? So in other words, companies can trade insolvently and the directors not be held accountable for that. But at some point, that may be turned off. But there again, you know, they extended the don't worry about reporting bad loans philosophy to the banks for another few months until, you know, March next year now. So in a way, you'd say, well, if you can do it for the banks, why don't you extend it for the rest of corporate land as well?
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, Caroline DeRusso made some interesting points in her recent podcast with the guys from Nucleus Wealth, just pointing out how the problem with extending the insolvency moratorium and all the various protections is that then you have this contagion of unpaid invoices, of basically all these good businesses being dragged down by the bad, because, you know, there's going to be all these unpaid invoices, all of these unpaid debts that are never going to be repaid. You know, it's never going to happen. And the longer that goes on, the more this contagion is going to spread when it's finally allowed, when the insolvency wave is finally allowed to hit.
Mm. Yeah, and there's a really interesting point. In fact, Nucleus Wealth made that point again, that, you know, we've moved away from capitalism, right? Basically, what we're actually doing is saying it's not now feasible for businesses to fail, right? So we will prop them up as best we can to keep them all going for as long as possible, right? But the longer you do that, the further you depart from the idea that actually capital is risk, risk is capital, and the, you know, if a business fails, that's because there are other businesses that perhaps are more effectively able to use that capital. So that is a fundamental part of capitalism, the destruction and creation of businesses. So if you are basically locking down the failure of businesses, then you've basically taken capitalism off its normal hinges, and you've got some alternative state-driven, state interventionist philosophy, which takes you to a really weird place.
Yeah, indeed. It's something that's also going to disproportionately benefit these larger businesses, because if we're talking about businesses not being allowed to fail, obviously the impetus is going to be far greater on, you know, a business that has 50 or 100 or 1,000 employees than, you know, the local corner hardware store, for example, that employs, you know, 5 or 6 people. And I think that's something that we're not only just seeing here in Australia, but we're seeing it around the world. You know, you're starting to see, you know, even say, for example, one of the best illustrations of that is Germany. You're starting to see the German government become intimately involved in directly investing and directly providing loans. And in some cases, they're talking about direct investment in large corporations, which, you know, it isn't capitalism anymore. Because if you're going to try and create a competitor to one of these big conglomerates, and you're just starting out, or you're a medium business who wants to be a competitor to one of these big conglomerates, there's no incentive for the government to ever allow you to get that big. Because there's going to be job losses, there's going to be losses of capital, there's going to be, you know, losses on the balance sheet for the government, and that's something that they're not going to want. So you're basically just sort of moving towards this almost, I wouldn't call it Soviet-esque, I'd say it would be more like China, more like state-owned enterprises getting preferential treatment.
Yeah, well, it really does twist the playing field remarkably. I was talking to, and look, I've been running some of my one-on-one sessions with a whole range of different people over recent weeks. It's been a very, very interesting exercise, not only in sharing some of my information about what's happening in the property market, but also getting quite a lot of input from people as to how they're thinking. But one thing that's struck out really strongly is that there are a lot of small businesses there who are saying, it is not feasible for me, for example, to have an apprentice and come and train them, because if I train them, they're just going to leave again, right? Or I can't get the funding that I need to be able to actually make that next business investment step in my business. These are all small businesses, right? So there is something weird that is basically saying small business in Australia, despite all the lip service from Canberra, doesn't get the support it needs. Nobody really understands what it's like to be there on the front line, trying to wrestle with all of the red tape, all of the processes and procedures you have to follow if you start employing people and everything else, and then not being able to get finance. We have got the small business sector really trapped in a corner at the moment. And yet it seems to me that pretty much all the initiatives that have been rolled out so far have been sort of up there at the top end of town. As you say, it's, you know, not really capitalism anymore. We're missing a really big part of the economy. And surely those small businesses should be where we should be focusing, because they potentially can become bigger businesses and then can create more value and more jobs.
Well, yeah, I mean, it goes well beyond that as well. I mean, small businesses are the lifeblood of the economy. You know, they're an enormous employer of people, and the thing is, you know, it's all well and good to protect all these bigger companies, but small businesses are the lifeblood of suburbia. They're the lifeblood of what you would probably consider to be the real Australia, and without the support, that is one of the things that really concerns me the most. Because, like as you say, we are only in the very, very early stages of this crisis. You know, this could go on for 4 or 5 years. You know, we really just don't know. And if these businesses are already falling over now, I remember you said in one of your videos, I think it was with Edwin, saying that 1 in 3 small businesses could close. What was it, in the next 6 months?
Correct. That's exactly right. That's from the surveys. It's slightly higher in Victoria, slightly lower up in Queensland, but yeah, that's the average.
Yeah. So, I mean, if we're having that many businesses close now, if we're having unemployment up around 10% in terms of the official headline rate, and probably far higher in terms of what we would consider to be the real rate, and we're not supporting these businesses now, what are things going to look like in 12, 18 months, 2 years time? I mean, it's kind of really concerning. I mean, it's downright scary in a lot of ways, to be completely honest with you.
We're going to end up with a smaller number of larger companies who will survive and will have got all those government supports. But we'll have lost a lot of the foundational and future businesses in Australia. That's how I'm reading it at the moment. And none of the initiatives that I've seen in any way address the needs of small businesses effectively. You know, they're talking about cutting red tape and all those things, but yeah, we've heard that for many, many years, right? Of course, the government strategy is, well, we'll offer tax cuts, right? Well, you know, tax cuts are going to go for the ones who's paying the most tax, right? That's how it works. So that may not be actually that effective in terms of actually stimulating what we need. It's like nobody gets where the foundation of our economy actually lives, and what needs to be done to be able to protect that and allow it to thrive and develop. You know, there should be investment in those small businesses. There should be an easier path to being able to help those businesses to grow and develop, because we can't just rely on large businesses digging up chunks of Australia and shipping it out to China into the future, and then relying on all of those big service industries like education or, I guess, tourism, both of which are turned off at the moment alone. We have to get the small business sector functioning way more effectively and needing more support. I mean, it's so obvious to me. I just don't understand why it is that the parliamentarians don't seem to see it.
I suppose it's about to be a tad cynical for a moment. You know, it's not the small businesses who... Yeah, me cynical? Who'd have thunk it? No, it's, you know, small businesses aren't the ones who drive the political donations. Yeah. You know, they aren't the one, you know, if you read the donor list of the Liberal Party, the Labor Party, you know, it's BHP, it's the big four banks, it's all these, you know, sort of big conglomerates. And just on the point of small businesses for a moment, I think that if someone sat down with Scott Morrison and explained to him exactly how many loans So how many business loans are collateralized against the principal place of residence and property? And the number of people, if one in three businesses goes bust, now if that actually fully 100% comes to pass, in all likelihood, that will crash the property market.
It's crashing anyway, so it'll just be another brick in the wall in terms of the whole thing falling over.
Not an even bigger crash there.
Yeah, no, exactly. But you're right. So if you look at the data, right? So of that one third who say that they're unlikely to survive in 6 months, and they're making some assumptions about no ongoing support. Roughly half of them have collateralized loans against their main residence. So that tells you that there are going to be a considerable number of small businesses caught in the headlights of this and essentially will have no choice but to put their property on the market. And that is a terrible thing for those individual businesses, but a terrible thing more broadly for the whole economy.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you happen to know like what sort of numbers you're looking at in terms of how many people could potentially be forced to sell under those forced into that difficulty under those circumstances?
Well, let's take some conservative numbers. Let's assume that there's around 2 million SMEs in Australia. It depends where you put the cutoff point, right? So basically one third of those are now saying, things aren't looking good. So, one third of 2 million. So it's a considerable, and by the way, quite a few people have a mortgage that is actually on their primary residence, which they're servicing as well, but also using the equity to support the business. So it's that duality, right? So it's quite complicated to unpeel. But yeah, I would have thought, even conservatively, you're looking at 250,000-300,000 forced sales potentially over the next 2 or 3 years if this goes the wrong way. But when I say forced sales, I don't mean banks foreclosing. What I mean is they take the decision proactively to say, I've got to sell, right? Because that's what I'm seeing at the moment in my servers. I'm not seeing the banks heavy-handing people yet, although some of them are being encouraged to consider their position, right? And we'll see more of that. What I'm saying is that people start to realize that there is no hope of them being able to pull the business back. And then they're trying to sort of manage the process out and beginning to think about, well, do I sell and how do I sell? So I suspect that's the process we're going to see. In a way, that will mask the defaults number, because I think the defaults number will stay quite low for some time yet. Remember that we have full recourse borrowing in Australia, which means that basically even if you sell the property and there's insufficient equity to pay back the loans, you still owe the loans. So that's something that people have forgotten about compared with the US, where in many states you don't have full recourse. So that's another factor to bear in here, right? You can't just hand the keys in. So this is a very complex situation. But now there's a significant number of businesses that look to me as though they're going to be forced to deal with their properties ahead.
Well, I mean, considering the sort of housing turnover rate, according to the RBA, of around about sort of 3% of around, 10, 11 million properties, 300,000 could potentially coming on the market over the next 2 to 3 years is just, it's an absolutely seismic shift.
Yeah, no, it is. And we know investors are also in that difficult situation. I did a show last night on the ABC, The Business. They got me on to talk about investor stress, and I let fly because I felt that it was time to actually just call some home truths. And I got quite a few pieces of feedback, mostly positive from people on that, because I was making the point that even property investors, the economy doesn't work for property investors now because the rentals are disappearing and there's no capital growth and negative gearing is less powerful. So another group that potentially will be thinking about selling. So wherever you look, you see more selling pressure on property rather than those who are still thinking of buying. Now, first-time buyers, we're still being bribed. They will still buy. Probably a mistake, but they probably will. And then, of course, you've got those up trading who can think, well, maybe it's a good time because, prices are going to fall and therefore I can buy bigger later. So, but, the whole market is being shifted and it's a seismic shift in property, right? And it's linked directly to all those broader economic factors that we've been talking about.
No, I agree. And I think that that's one of the sort of key things to keep in mind. A lot of people have been talking about support for the property market. And some people have been saying, look at the stock market, look at the support we've seen from the Fed, from regulators, loosening standards from the politicians, you know, throwing stimulus at the economy, or, you know, Trump tweeting all these sorts of, you know, this and that. But at the end of the day, the property market is different. The property market is directly linked to the real economy. You know, that is, you know, while obviously during the good times you've got the sort of relaxation of credit, the cutting of interest rates, all manner of different things that could support it. At the end of the day, as you've rammed home, you know, probably for a couple of years now, the key is unemployment. If people are unemployed, if confidence is impacted, then for example, CoreLogic had a thing the other day, I think it was CoreLogic, they had a thing the other day that showed housing turnover versus consumer confidence. And there's a fairly strong correlation between the two. So if we have poor consumer confidence, if we have poorer outcomes in terms of household incomes, in terms of unemployment, then property prices will have to fall. Mm. You know, it really is that simple. Yes, the government can arrest those falls, they can minimize those falls if they choose to, but it would also cost an absolutely gargantuan amount of money, in addition to already supporting all these different industries that are going to come out of the woodwork for probably close to a couple of $100 billion over the next few years, if not more, to be completely honest with you.
Well, I did a couple of back of envelope calculations, and look, these are rough, right? I reckon that if the government wanted to save the housing market, right, they would have to invest about the same as the total debt outstanding now, so 800 and something billion, right? If they wanted to support the banks but not support property prices, and allow property prices to fall down, but effectively provide support to the banks, so the banks and the financial system is maintained, that's about 200 billion, right? So those are the price tickets we're talking about in round numbers, right? These are big numbers. Now, I think the 200 billion number is not completely stupid, right? And therefore, I think it's more likely that they will focus more on supporting financial stability in the banks rather than trying to hold the property market up. That's my gut feel. Now, they'll try and do a little bit up to the election. But seriously, if you were going to support the whole property market, you're talking big, big hits.
Yeah. No, I agree. And I think another important thing to remember for people is that, you know, we've been talking about this for, 5 or 6 months now. Mm. But if you look at residential property investors and you compare them to, say, commercial landlords, you compare them to businesses, you compare them to all these different groups who have been either getting government support or desiring government support, they've got nothing. Residential landlords, they've got a mortgage deferral that the banks have managed to give them, but that's it. You know, there has been, you know, almost zero support from the government. And I think people have to look at themselves and ask themselves this question. Back in April, the RBA was talking about obscuring the fall in housing prices. They were panicking big time. And obviously, they were communicating with Treasury, they were communicating with APRA, then they were communicating with the government, right? And the government did nothing. I think people need to let that sink in for a moment. Even when it looked like prices were going to crash, the government did nothing. Mm. This isn't like back in 2008 when Kevin Rudd and the Treasury got that memo together that Joseph Walker got from Freedom of Information that showed them panicking and going, oh crap, we need to save the property market, we're going to do X. That didn't happen this time. And I think that's something that's really key to keep in mind, because not only that, but if this does deteriorate as significantly as we think it may, by the time the government intervenes with what little they will do, in all likelihood, because I can't see them completely blowing up the debt and deficit forever just to save the property market, or so I hope. And
there's a risk they do it, but
there is.
Yeah,
there
but is. I think it's unlikely. The quantum of investment they'd have to make, and I don't think it would be investment, it would be, you know, some other category of spending, I'm not sure what you call it, hope over anticipation perhaps, but look, I don't think it's feasible. I just don't think the numbers would stack up. So they're going to have to allow some drift down of prices, and it's going to be quite significant, I think, because it's already happening, and you know, the public indices aren't necessarily fully tracking what's going on yet, and people haven't yet started putting their properties on the market, so it's early days. The other thing about that observation earlier on about what the Reserve Bank was saying, right, they were basically saying, we might want to actually think about dealing with the fact that the data is you know, going to be shaky because of low transaction volumes and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So maybe we should turn off the flow of information so people don't get scared, right? I mean, that's basically the argument as I read it. Do you read it the same way?
Yeah, more or less.
Yeah, which is a really interesting argument, right? And they didn't do it in the end, but the fact that they were considering doing it is quite interesting, right? And then there was a paper from the Reserve Bank a couple of weeks ago that said, well, okay, property prices can drop 40% and there's nothing to see here, right? Now, hang on a moment. Which of those two schools of thought are actually right? Either they were really worried about the impact of prices falling, or they're saying there is nothing to see here, right? Now, if you look at that 40% number, which was a stress test, right, and look at the way the modelling was done, it was 17,000 households that they used. It was data from 3 years old, and it didn't take account of the critical observation that we're seeing, which is we've got structural unemployment now at the more wealthy end, because their argument was, well, those who are more affluent have plenty of capacity to support their loans, so that's not an issue. But unfortunately, jobs are now going in that sector of the economy. So I'm afraid that the RBA's paper was just not up to the mark. And so we've got this really interesting dilemma from the Reserve Bank, who on one side on the hand says, oh, we mustn't let property prices fall because that will be really concerning. And yet, oh, we can fall 40% and the banks will be fine. Where are they?
No, it's interesting when you sort of put it all together. Like I was reading a stress test, I think it was from 2017 from APRA, and they made a whole bunch of different assumptions regarding unemployment, regarding GDP growth, and it was caused by a shock from a slowing China. Now, I mean, you know, forgive me, economists, for I have sinned, but I think that's sort of pretty similar to what we're seeing now. In fact, I'd wager that what we're seeing now is probably significantly worse. And I think it's quite interesting looking at the RBA's numbers for, oh, housing prices are going to drop X, and then looking at APRA's stress test from 3 years ago that assumed that if all this came to pass, and I think unemployment's probably going to go higher than APRA assumed, yes, in that stress test, yes, they said housing prices are going to fall 30%.
Mm.
You know, 30% nationally. And I think it's really interesting that we've got this sort of massive data of all these different assumptions and all these different things that they said, oh, it's going to be really, really bad if this happens. And now it has happened.
Yeah.
And they're saying, oh, no, the banks are going to be fine.
Yeah. And well, here's a critical point, Tarek. Those stress tests that APRA did were on a bank-by-bank-by-bank basis, right? And they assumed in that the banks will be able to access the financial markets appropriately to be able to get the capital they need to be able to, you know, run it through, right? It wasn't a systemic crisis where effectively all economies around the world were being hit, right? And all banks in Australia were being hit at the same time. There was no joined up thinking about, well, hang on a moment, I've got six banks, they all need access to the capital market at the same time, right? So even those stress tests were pretty Mickey Mouse, right? And it was designed more for the optics, in my view, rather than actually being a really insightful piece of analysis. And that's what I keep coming back to with a lot of the stuff that's coming out from APRA, ASIC, and the RBA. It seems to be more about don't scare the horses and trying to calm the markets rather than actually being objective and independent, which I think they should be. I mean, ASIC came out the other day. Did you see that? James Shipton, who runs it, basically said, look, we haven't pursued the Westpac case, you know, because of responsible lending, because the world has changed, right? In other words, they're saying, yeah, banks can now do irresponsible lending. That's fine. I mean, what are they up to?
Yeah, no, but it's a systemic thing globally. Like, you're seeing these things, you know, like I was reading the other day, the US SEC is starting to reduce standards on what information needs to be supplied to the regulators in terms of financial information.
Yep.
You know, I mean, that's insane. The idea of, at a time when you're talking about sort of bond defaults heading potentially towards, you know, record highs in terms of, you know, this generation, at a time when you're talking about potentially an enormous systemic global crisis, you've just got the regulators and everyone just putting on this blindfold and putting their fingers in their ears and just humming very loudly.
Well, I suspect, you know, the three monkeys are probably spring to mind, right? You've got the politicians, you've got the regulators, you've got the banks, and they're all basically saying it's not my problem, it's somebody else's problem. And yet the real economy, you know, the real economy, the small businesses, all of those things, that's where the real pressures are being hit. And I have to say that the gap between where the regulators and the government is and where real businesses are and real consumers are is getting wider and wider.
No, I can't help but agree. I mean, all you have to do is look at the US. You know, you've got at last count from last night from the Bureau of Labor, you've got over 29 million people unemployed. Yep. You know, the government, you know, are all out there saying, oh, look at this recovery. And I just find it ridiculous, to be completely honest with you. You know, I mean, obviously, thankfully, Australia isn't as far down that sort of, you know, overt commitment to sort of rentier capitalism that we've seen in the US. But by the same token, you can't help but look at these numbers around the world and think, in net terms, the US has only regained about 3 million jobs from the peak loss of unemployment, you know, peak loss of jobs. And that's insane. That's absolutely nuts. You know, you're talking about, you know, more than 17% of the pre-COVID labor force collecting unemployment benefits. And it's not like Australia either, where you can just hop on unemployment benefits anytime you like, just because they've jacked it up and you feel like it. You need to have been employed relatively recently in order to claim it. And even then, there are time limits involved. And I just look at all of this high frequency data, the PMIs and everything else around the world, all these various data points. And like you say, the regulators and the politicians just have no idea. I mean, things are going down the toilet, even with tens of trillions of dollars worth of stimulus flowing through the system globally.
Mm.
And that should be ringing alarm bells, and people and governments globally and here in Australia should be panicking and thinking, oh, crap, what are we going to do to support this? We have to start right now.
Yeah, but you know the old definition of insanity? Which is you keep doing the same things and expecting a different outcome, right? Because the global financial crisis taught us that just throwing liquidity and creating money or moving money from treasury to the banks, right, to support the system didn't solve anything. It just created a bigger monster, right? And we've now got the mother of all monsters being created now because they're all doing the same thing again, right? At what point do people actually stand back and say, hang on a moment, central banks, you're nuts. This is not working and it's not going to work. It's not going to get us to where we need to get to. We need to complete an alternative path. We need a different way of thinking about the problem. And I, you know, how's that going to come about is the interesting question for me. Are we simply just going to sort of go around the houses for another year or two and just continue to print and print and print and print and print? Right. Some people are saying the Fed will print up to 10 trillion or something, right? But it's not going to necessarily get anything fixed. So we have to find a different path. And I wish there was more independent thinking within central banks and frankly within politicians' minds as well, to wake up and actually see that the models that have been perpetuated are not working, but more importantly, they can't work by definition. So we're actually going into this cul-de-sac, right, where rates are going to go low, low, low and stuck low. Unemployment's going to go high and stay high. There will be significant cost pressures building in the economy, particularly with the exchange rate where it is, and wages is going to go through the floor. That is the economic set that we're going to be faced over the next few years.
Well, I mean, the thing I think is insane is that, I mean, basically just echoing your own point, but expanding on it, is look at Japan and Europe. Yep. Both of them have much, much larger central bank balance sheets than the Fed. Both of them have thrown the kitchen sink in terms of money printing out their respective economies. In Japan, the BOJ has bought stocks. They're up to their eyeballs in everything. You know, their balance sheet is enormous. And what has it done? You know, what has the Nikkei done? What has the IBEX done in Spain? What have all these different indices done? And what has the real economy done? Absolutely bugger all. And you know, you've got a few bright spots, don't get me wrong, but a few bright spots when you're throwing trillions and trillions of euros or hundreds of trillions of yen at the economy and getting absolutely bugger all back is just it's just frankly insane.
Mm. Yeah, well, I agree. And look, there is this wonderful debate going on. Oh, wonderful. It's a very serious debate about inflation, deflation, right? And I'm still amazed how many people are arguing for an inflationary future, right? but not taking the lessons from the Eurozone and from Japan, who are further down the track and actually more committed to this strategy, and have not actually got anything working. So inflation is still very low. House prices in Japan are way down. Now, interestingly, if you look at individual households in Japan, because of the savings ratios and things, savings are actually quite high, right? Because, of course, people have been saving a lot. Guess what's happening in Australia now? The savings ratio is going up. People are going to save rather than spend because of their uncertainty. It's about the only thing that people can do is to try and buttress their own positions, because they're not trusting that the government or the politicians or the regulators or the central bank actually are doing the right thing. I mean, those are the sorts of real conversations we need to have. And look, we've got to find a different path. And now, so this is not something that you can just leave for 6, 12, 18, 24 months and say, oh, we made a mistake, right, we should be actually charting a different path out now, because as we started this conversation, we're at stall speed now. With all that money being thrown in, we're at stall speed, right? And now that money is being taken away again. And you think the airplane's going to take off now? I don't think so.
No, I think we're back to the airport analogy again. At least this time we're on the ground, I guess.
Well, stall speed is normally when you're flying.
I think you make a really important point with the savings rate. Like, it's something that's, like, as you say, structurally changed. And not only that, but one of the things that is interesting is that you would think that sort of popular wisdom suggests that as interest rates go lower, at least this is central bank wisdom, that is, as interest rates go lower, people save less because they get less in terms of the returns.
Yep.
And if interest rates go negative, who would be insane enough to save? And it turns out the Germans and the other European Europeans who are facing negative interest rates, yep, and low rates, yep, and deflation and all these, yep, other various factors. So, but I think one of the really interesting things is here in Australia is, we are probably some of the most bullish people on the face of the earth. We are some of the most positive and hopelessly optimistic people on the face of the planet.
She'll be right.
Yeah, exactly. She'll be right. Yep. And I think it's really quite telling to look at the savings right now and think about the context, in the sense that the government and the RBA and Treasury and everyone has said that this isn't the peak. Things are going to get worse. More jobs are going to be lost. More incomes are going to be shrunk. More people are going to face wage deflation and hours cuts and all manners of different things. And they think that the savings rate is going to, I've heard some people say, oh, but it's pent up demand for the future. It's like, yes, it is, when the economy finally recovers. But when's that going to happen?
Yeah, well, Frydenberg was very bullish about the savings rate. He regards that as glass half full, you know. My statistical data and my survey data says the reason people are saving is because they are very scared about what's going on, and they want to try and protect their families and their own livelihoods as best they can. And therefore, rather than spending a lot, they're going to put money aside. And did you see that the ABS, if you incorporate not only the standard savings, but also all the money drawn out from superannuation, it's something like 26% up or something, some remarkable number.
It's really quite telling to watch, to be honest. Like, I watch all this sort of stuff unfolding, and I think about it from a psychological perspective for Australians. Yeah. We are legendarily confident in our economy. We're legendarily confident in our ability to pay off our inflated McMansions and everything like that. But I think one of the really important things to keep in mind about this is that, overall, I don't think confidence in terms of the sort of long-term bullish, she'll be right viewpoint has really been all that badly hit. We've had a short-term sort of hit to confidence that people think, oh, it's the pandemic. In a couple of years, things will be better. But obviously, things aren't going to be that much better. We're not going to get back to sort of 2019 levels for at least another, Warren Hogan said the other day on Twitter that he was thinking, the end of 2022 at the best. And I think that really just goes to, speaks to the severity of our problem. Because if we do have a systemic collapse in confidence, if the sort of housing prices rise every 7 years, the government's going to bail us out, nothing bad ever happens to Australia, if that narrative for the sort of, middle Australia is finally shattered and revealed to be the sort of mirage that it actually is and always has been, what's going to happen to confidence? What's going to happen to the savings rate? How many more people are going to start saving even more than they are now, or how many people are going to start laying off workers. And it's really something that the government and sort of people in general need to consider. It's like, what if we do arrive at that world? And I mean, you know, let's say I'm wrong, you know, no harm, no foul, but what if we're right?
Absolutely. And look, it's worth making one point here. It's funny how now everybody's blaming COVID, right, for everything, right? So the virus did it, right? Just remember that we were already facing into an economic gale before the virus arrived. Unemployment was already rising. The metrics that we were looking at were actually pretty bad already, right? So what's happened is that this has catalyzed something and brought it out into the open that was already bubbling along, right? Now, of course, the politicians now can, you know, they've got their excuses, their plausible deniability, the virus did it, right? But if what they do is simply to try and then go back to the pre-virus scenario and try and just replay the last 4 or 5 years in terms of response to what's going on, right, then they have completely missed the fundamental structural cracks that were developing in our economy before this came through, firstly. And secondly, they're missing the opportunity to recraft and rebuild an economy for the future based on a different set of parameters. And for me, that's both the risk and the opportunity. There is an opportunity in all of this if people didn't see it. And yet, we seem to have leaders who are just wanting to say, no, it's going to be over quickly. You know, we'll just open the borders and everything will be fine. And then we can go back and we can use our old policies again. And we'll tax cuts a bit more and we'll do a bit here and we'll get rid of red tape and we'll do a lot more chatting and that'll be fine. I think people are waking up to the fact that that is a long way off what needs to actually go.
Indeed, it's just something. Like, I think one of the key things about a lot of the analysis that goes on about Australia, you know, whether it comes in a treasury or whether it comes from, you know, economists, is I find a lot of the time it doesn't really take into account the rest of the world. It's all well and good to say, oh, we're going to do this and we're going to do that and we're going to be fine. But if you look at, say, the top five global economies, you know, the US recovery, while you're seeing decent numbers coming out of the manufacturing indexes, there are 29 million people unemployed. Once the payroll protection program loans expire, that's gonna potentially rise even higher. You know, you look at China. Their data is shaky. New export orders, according to some indices, have never recovered. They've never even started to rise from the big drop that came, which is a massive canary in the coal mine for global trade. So that shows that the recovery in China eventually, in terms of its manufacturing, is going to falter unless those orders start to rise, which is looking fairly sort of uncertain considering the circumstances we find ourselves in. And then you look at Japan, which is a basket case, which was already heading into a recession anyway. You know, the word that the BOJ and the Japanese government like to use is the situation is severe. That's their way of saying things are stuffed. You know, and then you know, you look at Germany. They're doing probably one of the best in the world. But still, even then, the rest of the Euro periphery is now falling back into contraction, and that's going to drag them down with it. And they're also going to have all sorts of manners of political and economic issues in terms of the unity of the Eurozone, in terms of debt crises, in terms of bailouts. And then you get to India, which is another basket case, whose economy contracted the most of any major economy, down over 20%. And some of the best analysts in the world are saying that it's going to be an L shape. And I look at all these things and then I look at the bullish analysis for Australia of, oh, everything's going to be fine sometime towards the end of next year. And I just go, do we live on the same planet? If the rest of the world is struggling and struggling badly, we're going to get hit. How many students do you think are going to come from India if their economy is completely going down the toilet?
Yeah. Well, Tarek, what you need to do is to take off your sunglasses of gloom, right, and put on your rose-tinted spectacles, right, which is, of course, the ones that the Reserve Bank use, and then suddenly we're in the sunshine uplands and this is going to be a little wobble and then things will go fine, right, because that's how things really are, I wish. Unfortunately, I think you and I both agree that there are some very significant issues that need to be thought through. And unfortunately, we don't see much evidence yet of the politicians and even the regulators and those in charge of the various elements actually taking ownership of the issue and recognizing what we both recognize, which is that we're at stall speed And if we're not careful, that aircraft, which is just about keeping in flight at the moment, may meet the ground rather quicker than we might want to see.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, just on the sort of point of positivity for a second, I think the thing is, there are, as we've previously discussed in other videos, there are so many options.
Yeah.
So many. And with the amount of money flowing around, we could be solving enormous systemic issues. Absolutely. Relatively easily. And I think that's one of the saddest things about this, because one day, you know, we're going to be looking back on this crisis, we're going to look at the enormous pile of debt that we ran up, and we're not just going to think, oh god, that's a lot of money to have to be paid back. We're going to think, oh god, what could we have done with that? How much could we have accomplished? Yep. You know, I mean, I saw today on Twitter that some, you know, they tweeted that, you know, Lifeline was receiving a record number of calls. The ABS data shows that a record number of people are facing enormous, you know, psychological stresses and enormous, you know, mental health problems. Hmm. And then I look at it and I go, we had record corporate profits last quarter. We had $14.4 billion in profits, even though total sales of companies went down by $77 billion. And I did the math the other day for an article coming out in a few days' time. And in WA, the average cost of a new social housing home is $388,000. And they've also bought some off-the-plan apartments. So I imagine that's probably been inflated fairly significantly. But let's, for the argument's sake, use that number. For that $14.4 billion worth of corporate profits that were driven by and large by JobKeeper, we could have housed 80% of Australia's homeless forever. Now, whether you as an individual viewer agree with that or not is up to you, but think about what we could have done with $14 billion. It's a shed load of money. Caught myself from the swearing there. Nice. And it's something, you know, that we could achieve remarkable things with. You know, we could drought-proof Australia. We could do all these different things. And I'm optimistic, don't get me wrong, I'm optimistic that it's possible, but I'm also a political journalist who experiences the inner workings of all of this on a daily basis, and I just sort of have a hard time seeing how we sort of get to that.
Yeah, well, I agree. And look, just briefly, if you think back to the Howard Costello years, right, with all that money was coming in from, you know, the mining boom and everything else, right, they had decisions that they could have taken then. And they could have put the money into very different things than they did, which were just cheap tax cuts and, you know, buying votes, right? Which is pretty much what they did, right? Major mistake, decade plus ago, we're reaping the consequences even now, right? My worry is that we could be doing precisely the same again. If we rack up all of this debt and we're just basically throwing it around and doing the old plans again and just hoping it's going to work, right? Going back to repeating the past crises, doing the same responses and expecting a different outcome. We're missing the opportunity. And that's the point I guess I want to leave us with on this conversation today. There is an option. There are options available. There are alternatives. And those alternatives are viable because we know that with interest rates being very low, it is feasible to, you know, use that money and to invest it appropriately. It's about the political decisions that are being taken and need to be taken. And frankly, what those decisions are is pretty clear. But whether people will actually step up and take them for the right reasons, I think is very much in doubt at the moment.
No, I would love to disagree with you. I'd love to vehemently disagree with you and say you're completely wrong. Everything's going to be fantastic, but you're right. I mean, I just think of the absolute enormous number of things we could do. I mean, just think about for a second the idea that we could borrow for 30 years at less than 2%. That all these various schemes that people have cooked up over the years, whether it's like the Bradfield scheme, which, you know, sort of seeks to drought-proof Australia and improve, you know, agricultural land, or whether it's improving, you know, education and fixing up schools that are falling down, or any number of other things. I mean, I'm not going to go on and bore the audience to death, but there are so many things that are possible, and with the interest rates that are this low, and for that long, I mean, 30 years, I mean, that's a long, long, long time.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the idea that we can't derive some sort of economic gains or social gains that justify the economic cost for those things at 2% interest over 30 years just boggles my mind. I mean, you know, people should be beating down the Prime Minister's door with all these different plans to do things. I mean, and I don't even mean just because it's a crisis. I just mean because rates are so low.
Yep.
But in a crisis, it just should be happening even more.
Absolutely. That's the point, you see. And, you know, we're turning hopefully positive now insofar that out of crisis comes opportunity. But the decisions that we take through that crisis and the philosophy that we apply is going to actually be with us for the next 20, 30 years, like it or not. So let's hope that we make the right decisions and go the right way rather than just replicating mistakes from the past. Unfortunately, what I see at the moment is just no vision, no appetite for the new alternatives that are out there. And as you know, you and I often say, point of opportunity, but if that opportunity is passed, we're going to regret it for a long, long time.
Sadly, yes, it's a shame. It really is a shame. You know, I mean, if we had like a Franklin Roosevelt-esque leader who was willing to open the checkbook to build a country for tomorrow, things could be very, very different. And I'm extremely positive about what's possible, but I'm just not so positive that Albo and ScoMo and the rest of that, you know, our good friends in Parliament are going to be able to do what needs to be done. I feel like they're sort of trapped. They're trapped in this old way of thinking and going and sort of having a broader vision is a little bit impossible when you've got the sort of horse blinkers on and all you can see is the next election.
Yeah, that's right. Well, folks, opportunity does knock, believe it or not. There is, you know, an alternative story that could be told. And I guess that we'll probably come back and have another go at that next time, Tarek, because when you and I get together, we end up with some interesting observations. But it's interesting how there's a consistent pattern, which is it's all pretty gloomy. And yet there is light if we could but see it. And if we could activate that vision, there is a way out. So let's keep preaching that gospel.
Yep, there's hope, folks. There's a lot of hope. We just got to find it.
Exactly. Thanks for your time today, Tarek, once again.
No worries, mate.
See you later.
Bye, mate.
Bye.